at the end of the day, no matter what kind of person or you are in sort of audience development, you know, we are here to get readers on the page, whether, you know, you work on a subscription-based website like the Wall Street Journal, or if you're more sort of on the ad rev size, you know, we really want to connect with folks who would, at the Journal, we really want to connect with folks who would pay for, you know, high quality content from a trusted, trusted publisher.
Ladies, gentlemen, everybody, welcome back to a stacked full house of an episode of Media Voices. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Huster.
He's back, Yay! Baby!
That clip you just heard was from my interview with Edward Hyatt, Director of Newsroom SEO at the Wall Street Journal. So he talks about the differences in SEO strategies between subscription and non-subscription publishers, the impact of AI on SEO, and why it's more difficult to build relationships with readers from Google Discover.
That's specific, isn't it?
It's very, but that's the kind of practical, tangible stuff that I think we sometimes, we soar over, we do very top-down stuff. We glide over the media landscape as though in a 737, whereas really we should be trundling along.
Or crawling through it all on our hands and knees like some weird media tough mother.
Ah, that's perfect. We should launch that.
We should.
Speaking of slogs, if you want to keep abreast of all the news, and there is an endless amount of it in the media industry, you can go to voices.media and sign up to our daily newsletter. It contains the four most important stories of the day every single day of the working week. And as Peter loves to say, you will be the smartest person in any given room if you sign up and read it every single morning.
Slight tangent. Do you know what we should do? We should go do on. A Grub Street crossover and do Tough Grubber.
Ooh, that's pretty good.
Nice.
This first story that we're going to be talking about before we get to that interview is, Esther, you've described it as wild with a capital WILD. So, A, what is the story and why is it so, I suppose, contentious this week?
So Forbes has been caught using a tactic which probably they're not the only ones to be using, but they created, in a million years.
We'll talk about that.
This second website, which was www3.forbes.com, which was hidden from Google search. And you basically find it if you click on those awful chum box things in Outbrain and Taboola. It means that you're landing on this sort of crap content without really affecting the rest of Forbes and yeah, their brand image and whatever else. I'm not entirely sure how they got caught, but it's all blown up a little bit this week. Yeah,
these guys from Adalytics that are, it's like a 4-year-old trusted digital advertising startup. And they gave a report to the Wall Street Journal, and the Wall Street Journal went and investigated and published this piece. So as I understand this, these sites aren't like they're not just like crap sites with loads of advertising. There's actually something in the tech stack that's serving these ads super quickly, refreshing them super quickly. So you could have 200 ads served in a few minutes. Is that right?
It's a much greater, it's both actually. It's a higher proportion of ad slots, and it's also a higher proportion of, yeah, impressions because they're refreshed. But the main thing is these are sites which have been published. These are pages which have been published with almost no intent to ever be viewed by a human. They're purely there to scoop up some of that ad spend.
And they said it was about like 30% or something of ad spend that was going on sites like this, which is, if you think about the size of budgets that some of these ad agencies are dealing with, that's not an insignificant amount of money. That is just, MFA sites receive 21% of all ad impressions and 15% of digital ad spend. I think they say it was 30% of these specific campaigns that were going on.
Right.
But of course, this is the problem when you spend and you're spending with what you assume is a trusted publisher. Forbes, whatever else you may say about them, are a globally trusted publication. And then they're doing that. It's just really, there's no polite words you can use to describe it. But they are not the only ones.
I would be surprised if there weren't quite a few otherwise trusted publishers who were suddenly scrubbing quite a few of their subdomains of this stuff. As Steve said, it's about 15% of global ad spend. Back in 2022, it was 10%.
Yeah, and it's going rapidly. And I think The Forays, which is a trade organization for ad agencies, has sort of said that the way these work is that they're they're sort of made for arbitrage, meaning that they buy online traffic by advertising headlines elsewhere, places like these chum boxes. They sell the ad space for more than they paid to acquire that traffic and profit on the difference in cost. And part of me, just any plea to publishers that use these chum boxes, you know what that experience is when somebody clicks off your site and goes to these kind of sites. And people are sort of, you know, throwing their hands and saying, oh, you know, we'd never do anything like this. Well, I'm sorry, if you carry those chum boxes on your site, unless you've got them sort of set up to, you know, only serve your internal stuff, this is the kind of crap that you end up sending people off to. People that are stupid enough to click on stuff like that end up in this situation where they're getting the description is aggressively refreshing ads they display, potentially showing visitors the same ad thousands of times in a single session. It's fraud.
We're not talking about, you know, people trying to scam, you know, sell you scam mushroom cures and things like this. We're talking about major agencies, yeah, that is buying this inventory.
Yeah, which does speak to what we were talking about before, the fact that this is an indictment of the entire digital advertising ecosystem, because A, this is not just possible, but it's been kind of just quietly allowed for quite some time. Like, as you mentioned, this has been going on since 2017 for Forbes. Back in 2022, Ubiquiti said that this was going on had been going on for years and years and years. People have known of this. If you work in the industry, you obviously are aware of made for advertising sites.
There's all sorts of things that people are starting to put. Like, there's the sites that do that thing where they'll say, oh, continue reading after like two paragraphs of an article, and then they'll refresh the entire article, yeah, and all the ads. So, you know, you essentially get served as two users. There's an increasing number of people that are doing that. And there's a lot of practices that seem to be completely accepted by the industry. Pay-per-click is another one that really grinds my gears. That you'll get an advertiser, a huge advertiser, that will buy X thousands or millions of impressions from a large publisher. And if they don't meet that on their site, they will use pay-per-click on places, yep, like Taboola and Outbrain to meet the campaign. And it's like, it damages everybody. And I know somebody put in the notes here that it doesn't seem to really be affecting Forbes, but if you're then an agency and you're looking and saying, well, if I advertise with a quality publisher, this is what I get. It doesn't, yeah, just hurt Forbes, it hurts everybody.
Ever since, I think all of us, since we started the media briefing, have heard about the need to clear up the digital advertising ecosystem. There was talk, you know, if you ever seen the Loomscape, that was one of those things that was just like, here's the number of places, the number of middlemen. And then we got that down in terms of like the numbers. And yet there is still so much bad practice and these kind of practices which are taken for granted. And there's a perverse disincentive for even publishers like Forbes to get involved in that, because they know it does benefit them financially. And they are not on their own going to clear up the entire ecosystem. So why not just indulge a bit, you know?
You've then got big publishers going to agencies saying, this is our legitimate audience size. And they're like, yeah, but equivalent publisher over here has got an audience 10 times that. And they actually don't. But it's just... It's this huge inflated perception. The problem with a lot of digital media is that your real audience is probably teeny tiny.
But you know what people are like. People buy big number. They don't buy high quality. In fact, you know what? I'm going to take that back, because some advertisers do go to places. Like, some agencies will go to a private marketplace. They'll go to an Ozone, for instance, who actually are more transparent in where you're buying and in terms of demonstrating that return. I don't think the vast majority of brands would even know where some of the spend is going. You know, there's been endless studies which basically show...
the point, though, yeah, or the problem, that they should know. I mean, I've read the piece, a couple of really good pieces, actually, in the Media Leader from Omar Oakes. You know, and he's talking about all the major agencies spending money on this stuff, and they're spending money also on ad fraud detection services, but the ad fraud detection services have never picked this shit up. And it just sounds like some big, weird circle jerk. For want of a better phrase.
Didn't expect to hear circle jerk on the Media Voices podcast this week.
It does. It's like, we'll keep you happy if you keep us happy, if you keep these guys over here happy. I mean, it's just...
But you're right, we've got tech at such a level these days that it's claiming it can't detect this stuff. And then suddenly analytics is like, yeah, we can.
I think it's much more easy to detect than people say. I think there's a great quote in the Media Leader here from Omar where he says, the clear implication is that marketers just want to cover themselves by saying, we work with an ad verification company, without actually investigating whether their media is fraud-free or spoof-free. There is, to go back to what I was saying before, a perverse disincentive to actually get into grips with that, because then you have to do so much work to say, look, number go down, butt quality go up. It's like, you know that some CFO somewhere or somebody who's like, you know, involved in buying is going to go, no. I've got 6 months left in this contract. Number cannot go down.
What he's saying here is that working with these fraud detection companies that aren't actually investigating whether the media is fraud free or spoof free, he says it's like wearing a motorcycle helmet without ever actually thinking, oh, I wonder if this fits my head.
You know, it's dead internet theory. It's bots creating, like, you think that a human is creating anything on that page, even the content that sort of underpins those ads? It's bots placing ads repeatedly within bot-generated content for consumption by bots to then feed back to bots that these ads have been seen by other bots. And at some point, someone at the other end goes, that green line went up. Therefore, we must
exactly
be doing something
like
right.
That. But at some point, it's like the have you seen that cartoon where the bot sits in a bar and it's like, oh, can you buy me a drink? Because I've got no money. It's like the bot isn't going to buy the stuff being advertised.
No.
And at some point, this is just going to have to come crashing down. I don't know if third-party cookies will finally do it.
So I'm going to say something which sounds like I'm putting the blame on other people, which I probably am.
Oh, are you not taking the blame for this yourself?
It's not my fault.
I personally am not taking the blame for this. But, you know, people like me who work in the media have to take some responsibility. But actually, where this all went to shit was when it wasn't actual media or publishing people that started making these decisions. It was tech people started making these decisions.
It's programmatic. Once programmatic came along, that was a slope downhill.
As soon as you stop thinking, oh, I need a real human being that can maybe buy something at the other end of this value exchange, which is what publishing's been all about forever, right? Yeah. But instead, it's like how many eyeballs, how many clicks, how many impressions, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
God, I hate this industry sometimes. I absolutely hate it.
You have to do such an audit of your entire practice, not just your practices as a publisher, but everybody's. I think that there's a quote that we've got in here. I think it was from the Omar Oakes article where Ozone's Danny Spears is basically saying that people need to stop buying crap. But that is so much easier said than done. Obviously, he has a bit of a horse in that race.
Yeah.
But the fact is that if you want to buy anywhere outside of a PMP, you are taking, you pay your money, you take your choice, you know? It's like you're basically going, I accept that there's going to be a certain amount of fraud and there's no way to scour it all out. You can't burn this out. It's not like a wound that you can excise because it's shot through the entire body of digital advertising.
Whoa. That's kind of dark.
I actually do have a solution here, which I think would work and I think would benefit everybody. If everybody just stops spending willy-nilly and just spends all their money with media voices, that would starve these MFA sites of their reason for being.
And there's never going to be any ad fraud or spoofing on media voices because we fundamentally couldn't be arsed.
It's easier for us to be
too
honest.
Much like hard work. Trying to remember the stories that you told.
Which would be an entirely valid strategy if we ran ads on the website at all.
Listen, guys, we're too lazy to do fraud.
So all this talk about MFA sites and all this sort of thing, you know, you don't know where your ads are going, you don't know who the audience is. Do you know where it was really, really good to find out where your audience is? It's email newsletters. And if you want to come along and learn from some of the best publisher newsletters in the industry and the best publisher podcasts in the industry, we have the Publisher Podcast and Newsletter Summit coming up on June the 12th. The agenda is being released this week. Agenda. So, yeah, if you want to come along, please do. We've got a pre-agenda ticket rate going until the end of April. There'll be all sorts about paid podcasts, newsletter courses, and I'm going to leave that there because I don't want to give too much away ahead of the shortlist, ahead of the agenda reveal.
Always leave them wanting more.
Quality media, guys, quality media. So this week I spoke to Edward Hyatt, Director of Newsroom SEO at the Wall Street Journal. So Ed has worked for some major news brands in SEO, so I started by asking him how his career led him to the Wall Street Journal.
I guess it really starts all the way back when I was a kid. I used to make a lot of websites, and SEO was always a big part of that. So it was kind of in my blood and my bones, but
you were a really early nerd.
I was a big dork. I made websites for a video game series called Final Fantasy, so it was always a game for me to sort of find my website in early Google, essentially. But no, I studied film actually for my bachelor's and my master's degrees. But I've always loved journalism, and university really cemented that passion for me. And after I finished uni, I was sort of desperately trying to figure out how can I find some kind of balance for these two passions of mine. And SEO for news publishing sort of fit that Venn diagram perfectly. So that's how I got started, really. So I joined the Daily Mail as an SEO executive at the time, and that's where my career began. That's back in London. And I sort of worked my way up. I joined the Evening Standard, and then later I joined the Sun. And that was a really great opportunity for me. I worked with Carly Steven, who now heads up the Daily Mail as the sort of director of SEO. And she was a great mentor and really helped push me as an SEO. And one day I saw an opportunity that I couldn't really turn down, and I applied for a role at the Wall Street Journal, and here I am.
Is there a sort of difference in the way that the UK and the US publications approach things like that?
I think the answer is probably less UK versus US and more sort of what kind of a publication are you? So the Wall Street Journal was the first publication I've worked for with a subscription model. Before then, everything was very much sort of either print driven or very much sort of on an ad revenue model. So I think that's sort of the biggest difference versus the UK or US style of SEO. I would say the differences with Google could be quite profound in some ways. The way Google works regionally around the world, whether it's the US, the UK, Germany, or India, like that kind of dictates how you do SEO in a way. So I think that's arguably the biggest difference, rather than what I would do as an SEO in that sense.
I feel like when you started out in SEO, it wasn't really being taken hugely seriously. It was almost a sort of side thing publishers had, where, oh, we should probably get somebody in to sort of pay attention to SEO. I assume that's now changed over time, given that there's whole SEO teams at publishers. So from when you sort of started working at the Daily Mail, how seriously SEO has been taken changed?
Well, I honestly, where do I begin? I think you're definitely right. The way SEO is seen now is definitely slightly different to when I began. So my career began in 2015 at the Mail. And, SEO there was... It was important. Like, search was definitely a big driver of traffic, but it was more sort of, can we optimize this headline? Can we get some more keywords in here? And it's a very sort of one track kind of process in that sense, And I think as I've grown in my career, SEO has matured around me, and I think that kind of approach to search has fallen off pretty hard, even for the sort of very commoditized news websites and other websites in general, sort of try to stick to that approach. Like, it just doesn't really work. And I think when I started, again, back in 2015, social media was like the big thing. Like, some publishers even cut their SEO teams at the time so they could hire more social media folks. But I think as we've been hit by different changes to Facebook, and I guess I should say X now, I think SEO has really found its foot again. What makes search so valuable to publishers is that we are really focused on engaged, interested audiences. And that's something that social media can't necessarily do in the same way. We're not going, and no offense to anyone in social media, I am not a social person, but we're not going for viral hits. We don't want random clicks from somebody who fell upon the story. We're really aligned in our goals to engage a intent-oriented audience. you know, at the end of the day, no matter what kind of person or you are in sort of audience development, you know, we are here to get readers on the page, whether, you know, you work on a subscription-based website like the Wall Street Journal, or if you're more sort of on the ad rev size, you know, we really want to connect with folks who would, at the journal, we really want to connect with folks who would pay for, you know, high quality content from a trusted, trusted publisher.
Yeah. So in terms of priorities between the Wall Street Journal and the more ad revenue focused publishers, what are the differences in terms of their SEO priorities? I'd almost hazard to guess that maybe it's not as much of a priority for the subscription focused publishers as it is for maybe the ad revenue ones, but that might be wrong.
I think there's more of a diverse range of priorities when it comes to a subscription model site. You know, search is that for many publishers, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, way to reach new readers. So for a subscription model like us, you know, search is a very fundamental pillar in our sort of overall strategy. The same could be said of any subscription-based news website. We're being much more targeted in our approach. You know, an ad revenue site might want to hop on more trends to get more folks onto the page because eyes are what generates revenue for those publications. But, you know, we're trying to, I definitely didn't make this term up, but we're trying to be a bit more focused on search intent optimization. Like, how can we really engage with that intentful audience, that audience that want to read things by the Wall Street Journal on topics both they care about and we care about?
And do you find with working at the Wall Street Journal that you've kind of got to connect up? It's not just a case of filling up the top of the funnel with people that are interested. Do you find you have to work with conversion subscription teams just to make sure that that journey is all completely joined up for people that find the Wall Street Journal through search?
Yeah, it's a very holistic process. The search team in general, or audience teams in general, they kind of fit within this. You know, they're both part of the newsroom or part of the editorial team and work very closely and deeply on content strategy. But, you know, especially when it comes to search, you also might live in a world full of product managers and engineers, because all of these things sort of tie together. And then additionally, when it comes to subscription models like ours, you know, we might be more closely aligned to, you know, the team that works on subscriptions. Likewise, if we were an ad revenue team, we might be much more closely aligned to the ad rev team. So SEO really does kind of fit within this holistic nexus of, you know, what makes a website work. And I find that really interesting.
Given how much the algorithms change, or it feels like the algorithms change an awful lot, how do you keep up with what's changed, what's needed? Especially as the stakes are presumably fairly high if Google does a massive algorithm update and everything wobbles.
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a great team. I've got a team of three now. We just hired somebody the other day, which is great. So we sort of take a comprehensive approach to scanning the world for different notions of algorithm updates. I think Barry Swartz, for example, is a great name in the world of SEO that you can really check in with, and if anything is happening, he's posted about it, so you can always rely on some sort of industry leaders to make that clear. The question is, like, how do you then approach those updates and changes? And I think that's where it gets much more interesting. But yeah, I mean, there's a number of different tools out there too that you can use to sort of analyze your performance. Honestly, sticking to the basics, follow the people that are super engaged on this, whether it's on X or on their personal blogs or other websites. But also pay attention to Google and what Google is saying. They don't often give you a warning of a big update, but once it's out, they tell you, and it's really useful.
So it's a case that things that worked well a year ago might not work now, but the kind of the way that you approach that should always be consistent.
I think tactics might change. That's definitely been the case for a while. So, you know, back in 2018, when I was at The Sun, Google released something called the Helpful Content Update. And this was a super impactful core algorithm update that really touched upon all your money, your live content. So this was content that would in some way have some measurable impact on the reader's sort of, whether it's their finances or their health, or, you know, these really sort of high risk type topics. Google came for those. Lots of news publishers used to rank extremely well for a lot of health content, especially. And I think Google probably asked itself the question, like, is this the best experience for readers who are looking up like illnesses or like looking for financial expertise? Like, do we really want quote unquote non-expert publishers ranking highly for these types of topics? So what we saw after that was websites like John Hopkins or the NHS like ranking really well for that type of health content. While the tactics that SEOs might employ to perform well in the search results, the strategy from Google, I think, is pretty consistent. Like the principles of what it's trying to do, it really wants to help. Like it says it wants to help people. It wants to make sure that people can find helpful content that was written for them. And they want it to come from experts, people who may have experience with that topic that they're writing about, that they have authority on the topic. And I think that's really key. And even the latest update that came out in March was tagged to a spam update as well. Google's making it really clear and have been for some time that it wants high quality content, and it wants high quality content that's helpful to readers. And I know that probably sounds like a cop-out answer, like Google says this, but I think at the end of the day, that is key. Like, how can you be useful and helpful to readers who are interested in your content? And I think journalism websites or news publishers, you know, we should really be deeply focused on that. Everybody has heard of Google Discover, and I think it does kind of feel frustrating, I think, when it comes to Google Discover, because it doesn't always, in my opinion, give you helpful content in that sense. But
it's a bit of a black box the way that works, isn't it?
It is a black box. And, you know, it's a really tough one to decipher. But, you know, if I'm to look at my Discover feed now, like, I don't have particularly helpful content or like high quality or expert content here in the same way that I think I would find in the search results.
Do you think there's still a bit of a gap between the products Google has for that kind of search and discovery and what's actually on the market at the moment? If Discover isn't doing the job, do you think there's something else that publishers or publishers in Google should be working on that would be more helpful? Or do they just need to be more collaborative over Discover?
It really depends what you mean by getting the job done. Like, Google Discover definitely gets its job done. It can drive a lot of traffic. It can really engage people. The question is, like, how can publishers use that those readers or sort of reach those readers coming in through Discover and actually retain them and build relationships with them? That's the most difficult thing to do, because people who are coming in from Discover, they weren't that intentful audience. Like, to a degree, you know, they have obviously interest in the topic. Otherwise, Google's personalization algorithm wouldn't have shared that story with them or that piece of content. But because they weren't looking for it, they just came across it. Like, it's much harder to build connections with readers who are sort of, you know, just going through a list of results and finding things they just find interesting in that moment.
A lot of this has already revolved around Google. Are there any other kind of competitors to Google that you sort of think publishers should be maybe paying more attention to, or is Google still the dominant force in SEO?
Well, I think there was definitely talk when Bing added the chat AI function to its search results. And, you know, there was some thought around, could Bing make a dent in Google's dominance of this industry? But I think, and I don't have it to hand, but one of the recent reports into sort of Google's dominance of search shows that Bing hasn't really made a huge dent, and that Google still makes up roughly 90% of the the search landscape. So Google still really is the one to pay attention to. And I would argue, if you're optimizing for Google, if you're really thinking about making helpful people first content, then that should also work for other search engines. But certainly a lot of different products out there, whether it's Bing or even some of these newer generation search engines, like Perplexity, AI type search engines. So yeah, I think Google is still the big one to sort of keep an eye on, but there's a number of others that you might want to pay attention to in the coming years.
We did very well to get that far without mentioning AI, but now you've mentioned AI, I've got to ask. SEO is one of the areas that a lot of people have said is really under threat from generative AI. If people are searching and they get the answer straight away, and I know Google's had zero-click search as a priority for a number of years, but Gen AI has really got people in a bit of a panic. What's your view on this, and how are you preparing for it at the Wall Street Journal?
This is a great point, and we did have to get to this eventually. And, you know, AI is definitely, broadly speaking, like one of the most disruptive changes I think the SEO community has seen for a very long time, possibly ever. You know, and to your point, in some ways, it is the next step in the road towards zero-click search. You know, it's where Google has been trying to get to for some time, like try to be useful to people within the search results themselves. But I think not every website or type of website is going to be impacted in the same way. So, you know, just doing some experimentation and research myself, you can really see impact on things like reviews. So if you were to type in Kindle Paperwhite review, you know, you'll find that Google's SGE gives you a generated response of what it's sort of summarized from all the reviews out there. And then it immediately gives you links to buy pages. It's sort of bypassing the entire publisher process in that sense. But I think the hope, I think, for those types of websites is that readers want to see an expert's opinion. So I think really, again, just sort of toe that line here, like really stay focused on what audiences need. The people who would click on those buy pages straight away, like directly to Amazon or directly to other competitors, they might always have done that, and that might have been their goal all along. But really find your audience, and that I think is the key. And for publishers like us, or well, for any news publisher really, I think the real question is around commoditized news. Like AI search engines like SGE are commoditizing news. So I think it definitely means that some of the goalposts are shifting. And for publishers, you know, like the Journal, other high quality subscription publishers like, you know, the Times or the Atlantic or the Post, you know, it really means doubling down on that high quality content that is resistant to being commoditized in the same way. Focus on your brand, connect with audiences that care deeply about the types of coverage that you focus on, and use that to build an engaged audience through the search experience. So while Google will definitely and is trying to summarize news content via SGE, providing those deeper, more analytical takes that are sort of a bit more distinctive, that's really the way to approach SGE. SEO is not really about getting as many eyes on the page as possible anymore. It's about getting the right eyes on the page in that sense.
So I suppose it's a really crude example. It would be people searching for kind of deeper analysis on a particular news event rather than people just looking for the top level details.
Not even just the top level details versus deep analysis. A lot of publications, like their number one driver of conversions or sort of eyes on page might be an exclusive, and that, you know, if you are in a publication that's invested in investigations and other types of long-term reporting strategies, then, you know, that type of content will definitely be resilient to SGE. So to your point about sort of deep analytical takes, that's not always the issue. In fact, Google in 2022, what they said was they wanted news publishers to sort of focus on coverage that they are experts in, that their audience are interested in. I think it was called the news product update. And I think that's what publishers ought to take quite seriously as well. You know, really focus on your brand. You know, trying to chase the trends, especially those commoditized trends, like that might get you a short-term win, but long-term, like that strategy just isn't going to work.
And is SEO something that is a job for one person or a small team? Or do you think it's helpful that everybody's at least got an idea of how it works, maybe some of the things they need to be looking to focus on?
Yeah, that's a really great question as well. I think when I first joined the journal back in 2019, actually, we got involved in, well, I got involved in some broader sort of SEO strategy in the wider business. And Jenny Baird, who's now at the BBC, she was leading the group at the time. And she had this really important message that impacted me greatly. And I know it wasn't just me, it was other colleagues as well who sort of took this to heart. And I don't want to misquote it, so I won't quote it exactly. But the goal was like to make SEO a second language. You know, it's a language that everyone should be speaking. It's absolutely not a job for one person or even a small team of people. You really need your entire newsroom or your entire organization, whether it's, you know, your editorial teams, your coverage chiefs, or your product managers or your engineers. You know, you really want everyone to be thinking about the impact that it could have on SEO. You know, if your engineers release a product that is not fit for search, that's unfortunate. You've just lost a big channel. So while you do need folks who are experts in SEO to help guide and build strategies and identify issues and sort of be that bridge between technical and product for SEO reasons, you really need everyone to be on the same page.
And what is top of your priority list as director of newsroom SEO this year, apart from AI?
I mean, to be fair, everything at this point is relating to AI and the future of search in general, but it's really focused on what I've been talking about already, which is how can we find our audience in search? You know, staying very focused on that search intent optimization idea. It's not just about trying to reach everyone. It's about trying to find the right people who find value in the Wall Street Journal.
And finally, what do you think is in store for publishers in terms of their SEO strategies this year?
I think it's going to be, you know, I hate to say it, we've talked about it a lot, but I think AI in some way is going to be integral to any SEO strategy, whether it's sort of AI in the search results or, you know, how newsrooms create content, how newsrooms sort of utilize AI for their processes and things like that. So I think AI at the end of the day is kind of a game changer for SEO. I expect to have more core algorithm updates throughout the year. They may go further than the March update and the spam update, but you know, you really want to follow the right people on X and follow the right blogs to keep on top of that. You know, Google is staying hyper vigilant on spam content. In early May, their spam update will sort of roll out. So do in the next month, like assess your site and make sure you're not creating any content that might be at risk from an update like that. But personally, I'm really interested to see how Google will handle election misinformation here in the US later in the year. So it will be really interesting to see if sort of fact check boxes and things like that might become more prominent in the search results. I would imagine they would tone down AI, generative AI for, you know, the SERPs at that time too. So I think those are, the as broad as they are, the key things to look out for.
And if you are desperate for more media news, you can sign up to our daily newsletter. Now, that goes out every day of the working week, Monday through Friday, and it contains the top four stories that you really need to know, carefully curated by the three of us. You can sign up to that by going to voices.media. And please, if you're already signed up, please do forward it across to somebody else who you think might like it.
They should flicked it on someone else.
So just stick it on an MFA site somewhere, it'll be fine.
Also on voices.media is the shortlist for the upcoming Publisher Podcast Awards.
Woo!
If you want to, you can go to publisherpodcast.com and see the shortlist there too, and you can click through there to listen and, more importantly, buy tickets for the awards and the associated summits. Seriously, some of the people on that shortlist, oh my God.
But until next week, when we'll be back with the last episode of the season.
I know, crazy.
Ah, mental. 10 episodes has gone quickly. Goodbye.